Dr. Fournier has decided to cut the mission short. We're going home, a little earlier than expected. Home? Greaves is confused and then alarmed. But we haven't made all the stops on the schedule. There are still two more samplings before we... Rena is nodding. I know, I know. But if there are junkers up here, it changes everything. It's just not safe to keep going when we don't know what's in front of us. And it's not as though we're finding anything different, anything we can actually use. Greaves swallows hard. What if we were? He asks. There is a tremor in his voice. But Rena doesn't seem to notice it. She shrugs almost dismissively. Well, even then I think I'd vote for going home.
But the mission!
Greaves protests again. Rena laughs, but the laugh has a catch in it. The mission needs some fresh thinking, she says, and I need to get back home and have this baby. I wish it hadn't happened like this, but I'm still glad to be going back. It just feels terrible to be relieved about something that's so... A vague motion of her restless hand picks up where the words leave off. Greaves interprets. She is happy on her own account, but unhappy because Private Lutz is dead. The disparity between these two emotions makes her uneasy. He is amazed to find his own experience, the mingled guilt and excitement he feels, reflected in hers. It doesn't happen to him often. He wants to explore the similarities, but he is afraid to. He is still holding the biopsy needle close against his side. The longer the conversation goes on, the more chance there is that Rena will see it and ask him about it, or else that she will want to know what he was doing off by himself in Invercray. As though his thought has triggered hers, Rena looks over her shoulder into the crew quarters. They're not very happy with you, she tells him. It's not entirely clear who she means. The crew quarters have emptied out. The soldiers have gone outside, most probably to replace the motion sensors and perimeter traps now that Rosie is stationary again. The colonel has gone up front, and Dr. Fournier has contrived to disappear too, leaving only Akinwe, Seely, and Penny. Despite this, Greaves decides that Rena's words must apply to all the crew, irrespective of uniform. He wants to say he's sorry, but that will invite further discussion. He says instead, I won't do it again. It's a reckless promise, but the future tense pulls them both away from the dangerous waters of the recent past. Almost. You can't, Stephen, Rena tells him gently. Not any more. You're not responsible for what happened back there, but if there's a Junker Carder somewhere close by, then we're in real danger. You know it was probably Junkers who got Charlie. We don't know that, Greaves points out, but he's being pedantic. The commander of the Charles Darwin talked in her last transmission to Beacon of being pursued by a large group of Junkers riding battle trucks to which Hungries had been harnessed like oxen. She said she would avoid engaging as long as she could, but would fight back if attacked. Her last words were, "They're flanking us." "They're really dangerous," Rena insists. "People think of them as savages because they choose to live out in the wild rather than in Beacon. But they live by scavenging, and they're really good at it. They have to be, or they wouldn't have lasted this long. They look at Rosie and they see guns, ammunition, equipment, food, all kinds of things they need. We're worth a lot of effort in their eyes." Greaves nods cautiously. He is agreeing with the explicit meaning of her words, the Junkers are a serious threat, rather than with their secondary implication, there are Junkers here. It's not a lie, because he hasn't opened his mouth, but once again he is allowing someone to believe a thing that isn't true. His mind itches, and an iron bar of tension presses against his shoulders. But Rena seems satisfied with his reaction. Possibly she mistakes his tension for a salutary fear. "So when Dr. Fournier decided to turn us around," she continues, "he was doing the only thing he could do. We'd have to be crazy to carry on all the way to the coast with the Junkers behind us." She is looking at Greaves expectantly. He nods again.
Yes,
he says. But this time he is compelled to add, if there were junkers here, that would be bad. So we're doing the right thing. Everybody thinks so. Everybody agreed with the decision. Greaves glances into the crew quarters again. He finds it very hard to pass emotion, but the cues he has learned to associate with celebration are notably absent. Dr. Akinwe is sitting in silence at the table, his chin resting on his fist, his eyes wide but unfocused. Dr. Penny rubs her pursed lips with the knuckle of her thumb. Dr. Seeley talks to them both in low tones, striking matches from the box above the kitchen unit, and letting them burn down in his hand before dropping them, one by one, into the sink. These are not behaviours Greaves would expect to see if everyone is really comfortable with Dr. Fournier's decision. But then, agreeing with something is a cognitive rather than an emotional response. Rena has already told him what the dominant mood is. They're not very happy with you. Greaves can't make this right. Private Lutz is dead. The mission is over. There is nothing that he could put on the opposite scale that would be big enough to balance these huge, remorseless facts. Nothing except a new and radically important discovery. A cure. A cure for the hungry plague. Rena tries to temper what she has already said, to spare him further pain. Stephen, she tells him, they're mostly unhappy because the mission is a washout. Today was bad, but even without today, we weren't getting anywhere. You know that. The whole point of the sampling runs was to find an inhibiting agent, something that makes cordyceps grow more slowly or stops it from growing altogether. But we haven't managed to do that because there isn't one. We're going home empty-handed. That's what hurts. She leaves him to it. She has done what touch can do and what words can do. The only other variable is time. Greaves watches her rejoin Dr. Seeley and the others. The weight and import of the moment make her forget herself enough to reach out and take Dr. Seeley's hand. They look into each other's eyes, enjoying some wordless communication. Greaves would find that combined touch and gaze unbearable, but he knows that for lovers, meaning people who share physical intimacy, such things are an important means of overcoming the isolation of monadic consciousness, or seeming to. We're going home empty-handed. He replays the words in his mind three times over. It was true yesterday, but it's not true now. The contents of freezer cabinet 10. The slender cylinder of cortical tissue in the biopsy needle. He can still make this right.
Chapter 23.
Dr. Fournier is afraid that he may have overreached his authority. In the engine room, with the door closed and locked, he tries once again to raise Brigadier Fry on his secret radio, which despite its tiny size has always outperformed the main cockpit radio in terms of reach and signal strength. But yet again the Brigadier fails to pick up. Fournier wishes very fervently that he had been able to ask her before he gave the order to turn around. It wasn't fear. He didn't do it because he was afraid, although he is. Afraid of dying, and even more afraid of not dying, of being bitten and left abandoned up here in the north while Rosie rolls home, a living but cordyceps-ridden scarecrow standing out in a field forever while the seasons wheel and turn. But it was anger, in the end, that pushed him over the precipice of decision. He is going to be judged on what the expedition has achieved, and he will be judged harshly because they have achieved nothing. They left Beacon to cheers and fanfares, bottles of bootleg liquor smashed across their bows. The 12 of them in their tin can, carrying the blessings of the 1.5 million they were meant to save. Now they will sneak home through the back door and be forgotten. Suddenly, seeing that shame and blame vividly in his head, He found in himself an unexpected eagerness to face it full on and answer it. You could have done no better. Nobody could have done better. We didn't find an answer because there isn't one. And perhaps there was a part of him that was thinking, Lutz is probably only the first. He's proved that it's eminently possible for us to die out here, and after the proof you can expect to find more and more instances that support it. Perhaps, yes. But it doesn't really matter now. He found his voice. He found his authority. He made his decision, and he carried it. This, squatting over the radio, teasing its tiny frequency controls with cold and clumsy fingers, waiting once again to be put in his place, is the price he has to pay for that. After 3 failed attempts to raise the Brigadier, he decides to wait a while. Rosie is stationary, of course, so there is no chance of moving into an area with better reception, but the fall of night sometimes sharpens the signal all by itself. This digging in was at Carlyle's insistence, and Fournier didn't argue. For Rosie to move at night is a hazardous proceeding. Most of the roads are blocked with rusting cars, the poignant remains of a 10-year-old exodus. The going is hard, even with full visibility. The colonel has decreed that they will bivouac for the night and move out in the morning. It seems to be so easy for the colonel to constitute himself as an authority when other authorities fail. For Fournier, it's very hard. His natural mode is submission. His relationship with Brigadier Fry fits very well into this pattern, and always has since the first time he ever met her. It was before his status as civilian commander was officially confirmed. He had been interviewed by 3 representatives of the main table, and he felt he had done well, portraying himself as a safe pair of hands, a man who would stick to his orders no matter what. But then the Brigadier, a senior officer in the military muster, asserted a right to interview him too. After some to-ing and fro-ing, she won her point. In her command tent, between the 2nd and 3rd of Beacon's 7 perimeter fences, she welcomed him without using his name, and poured him a whiskey without asking him whether he drank. She had some questions about his relevant experience, both as a scientist and as a team leader, but they were generic enough that they didn't even prove she had read his file. She seemed a lot more interested in talking about Colonel Carlyle. The colonel is an important man, and he's going to be away from Beacon and the main table for a long time. He'll be missed here. Fournier had no opinion about this, but he nodded emphatically. Oh yes, I'm sure of it. The mission will be lucky to have him. That seemed to him to be the answer that was required, but the Brigadier didn't appear overly enthused by it. I would like to think, she went on with cold and careful emphasis, that the civilian and military commanders will form a mutually supportive team, watching each other's backs, as it were, assessing each other's competence, even, and stepping in as necessary to provide whatever assistance or corrective might be needed. This time Fournier said nothing, but only nodded, a safer bet all round. We here in Beacon, in the muster, I mean, are quite keen to keep track of the colonel while he's outside the fence. Not just where he is, but what he's thinking and feeling. We're concerned for his well-being. Dr. Fournier chewed this over for a few tense seconds. Would another nod be enough of a response? He was pretty sure that it wouldn't. May I be frank? He asked, too late to keep the pause from becoming noticeable. By all means. Are you asking me to spy on the colonel? Fry breathed in and out, audibly. Not quite a sigh, but most of the way along. Morale here in Beacon is volatile at the moment, she said, which seemed to Fournier to be no answer at all. The muster works at the behest of civilian authorities who often don't entirely understand our workings or share our priorities. Hence the double command for this mission, and hence our being allowed to vet you, even though your role, if you were accepted, would be civilian commander. I understand that, Fournier said. I'm glad. the candidate we interviewed before you, and, if I may return your frankness, the preferred candidate for the position, didn't. She seemed determined to misunderstand us and define her role entirely in terms of the mission's scientific objectives. We felt this was too narrow a point of view, that to ignore the political dimensions of what's happening here was obtuse. Fournier tried to hold back, but couldn't. The feminine pronoun was a deliberate tease, dangled in front of him to see whether he had enough self-control to keep from guessing. He didn't. Caroline Cordwell. Caroline Cordwell was your first choice for this. Fry affected to be surprised at the question. I said she was the preferred candidate overall, Doctor. I didn't say she was my choice. In fact, I would much rather have someone in post whom I could rely on to see and serve the bigger picture. Science and politics are not two worlds. They're two hemispheres. Fournier, who had never seen himself as a politician, but now at least had an inkling of the job description, agreed. Two hemispheres, yes. Very aptly put. Very insightful. Caroline Cordwell in the Rosalind Franklin, and him left behind in Beacon, polishing other people's test tubes, other people's reputations. No, no, no. This was the future, if there was to be one. The forge on which the future would be made. He knew very well that he was a competent researcher rather than a great one, but still. He couldn't choose irrelevance when greatness was on the table. Surely nobody could. With the stakes clearly established, he continued to agree with every proposition the brigadier put to him. Fry suggested that he might need to form a judgment on the robustness of his staff, their morale, the clarity of their motives. He said he was good for that. She demonstrated the operation of the radio, emphasizing that its existence must remain a secret. He promised her that he would be the soul of discretion. She indicated that the muster might wish to give him additional orders in the course of the mission, depending on how certain events in Beacon itself fell out or failed to fall out. He said that he would not object to that. When he left her office, he was brimming with self-disgust, his stomach sloshing and griping with it. He wanted to be sick. But by the time he got back to the lab, he was already feeling much calmer. Compromise wasn't a swear word, and expediency wasn't a sin, especially not when it came to the big turning points in your life. The world was going to be saved. Rosie was the surgical instrument, and humanity was the patient. Who in their right mind would choose to lie down on the slab when they could be the one holding the scalpel? Now, 7 months on, he feels that the scalpel is at his throat. The mission was already a shambles even before the death of Private Lutz. In despair of finding anything of value, wearied to death with this confinement and cowed by 2 strained, awful weeks of inexplicable radio silence, he jumped at the chance to turn the car around and head for home. Brigadier Fry's last words to him, "You may be tempted at some point to renege on our agreement, Dr. Fournier. With everyone calling you Commander, it will be easy to fall into the trap of actually trying to command. But that's really not what you're there for. As far as your scientific expertise goes, I won't presume to advise or direct you. But everything else is mine." Chapter 24 McQueen sits up in the turret while the sun sets and the stars come out. In his mind, he identifies and names the constellations he can see. The dragon, the little bear, Cepheus. Mostly he learnt them for their use in orienteering, but he is struck, too, by the beauty and profligacy of their display. The daytime burns with a single fire, and a lot of the time it burns fitfully. The night is a million suns exploding all at once, igniting the whole sky. With no man-made lights to dim them, they have reclaimed the glory, the pre-eminence they had back in the Dawn Age when humans lived in caves. Even through the distorting curve of the turret glass, they make McQueen feel as though he is about to fall off the tilted world into the immensity beyond. No Hungary's in that infinite light show. No junkers, no lies or bullshit. The world ended more than a decade ago, but the news hasn't made it out there yet. And it won't make any difference when it does. Perfect truth is black and white, and it doesn't know our names. McQueen is wrestling with his pride and with his definition of himself. He isn't enjoying it, but he doesn't shrink from it either. It's absolutely necessary to know who you are, as the basis for knowing anything else. Cutting loose with the flamethrower felt necessary and obvious at the time, as though it was just the part of the equation that comes after the equals sign. He didn't think about wind speed or their own displacement as they moved. He just thought about the response that needed to be made to that dead man on the ground, hacked to the bone like meat on a slab. In other words, he lost control. Carlyle called the play, and he called it right. You don't do a broad sweep with a flamethrower from a moving vehicle, unless you want to fry yourself and everyone who's riding with you. There are only two ways you can go from that realization. You can make up stupid stories about how you were actually right all along because X and Y and Z and all the rest of it, or you can admit you screwed up and try to be better. McQueen climbs down from the turret. His limbs are heavy and he feels tired to death. It seems appropriate that emotions should have recoil in the same way guns do, because after all, they're just as dangerous. But that doesn't make it any more pleasant to endure. To get to the cockpit, he has to walk through the crew quarters. There's a mixed bag of soldiers and white coats in there, and they all look up when he comes. Foss is the first to react. She stands up quickly and rips off a salute. As a signal, it's pretty unambiguous. Phillips is right behind her, Sixsmith a little slower, but inside of a couple of seconds the three of them are standing there, defying regulations and telling him he's still ranking officer here. "You have got to be fucking kidding me," Dr. Khan exclaims, appalled. McQueen enjoys that part, at least, but he needs to nip this little revolution in the bud. He returns Foss's salute crisply and punctiliously. "A little confused, aren't we, Lieutenant?" he says. "Never mind. It will sink in eventually." He walks on, leaving silence in his wake. The cockpit door is open. He goes in and closes it behind him. Carlyle sets his book aside and nods towards the shotgun seat. McQueen stays on his feet, even though he has to stoop a little because of the low ceiling. "Permission to speak, sir," he says. The colonel shrugs mildly. "Of course," he says. McQueen doesn't beat about the bush. There is no point. "You were right about the flamethrower," he says. "I used it without authorization and without due care, as you pointed out. In doing so, I risked the safety of the crew and the vehicle. I deserve a reprimand for that, and I accept it. But I'd like you to restore my access to the turret guns. We're in a bad place, and with junkers in the mix, it could easily get worse. You may need me, and I can't do much if I'm not allowed to touch the silverware." Carlyle is silent for a moment or two. McQueen waits for the verdict, wanting this to be over. "Will you sit down, Private McQueen?" the colonel asks him. "No offence, sir," McQueen says, "but I didn't come here to kick back and talk about old times. I just need a yes or a no." "Then it's no." The colonel's tone is flat, emotionless. McQueen feels that recoil again, this time in the form of a cold fizz of static through his nerves. He thinks he must have misheard. Considering the magnitude of the climb down he has just made, the fireman's answer makes no sense. "Sir, I don't think one error of judgment, Mr. McQueen." The colonel drops the words like a bulk of timber cuts him off dead. "If the flamethrower were the only issue, I would agree with you. But it's not." The colonel stands, wincing as he momentarily shifts some of his weight onto his injured leg. Clearly it's important to him that they be on the same level for this, one way or the other. "Your whole attitude," he says heavily, carefully, like a doctor delivering a terminal diagnosis, is at odds with military discipline and the outlook required of a soldier. To serve in an army, in a militia of any kind, is to subordinate your own wishes and instincts to the orders of your commander. A soldier may have his doubts, but he does what he is ordered to do, whereas you, Mr. McQueen, seem to regard orders of any kind as an insult to your professionalism. McQueen can't believe he's hearing this, or who he's hearing it from. And maybe he should keep his mouth shut until the sermon is over, but there are serious arguments to be made, and he already has permission to speak. "I know all about following orders, sir," he says. "I also know where it can lead to." "Thank you," Carlyle says gravely. "That is exactly the point I am trying to make. It seems to me that you obey where it's absolutely required, but that you do so in a spirit of reluctant compromise. Knowing that your own instincts are more reliable and that you could achieve more if you were left to your own devices." "That's not true," McQueen says. "Really. Standing orders dictate..." "Shit, I already admitted I got it wrong. Once. I got it wrong once." They're matching point-blank stares, practically stepping on each other's toes. The cockpit's narrow confines are pushing them towards confrontation whether they want it or not. "Standing orders," Carlyle repeats heavily, "dictate that if the situation on the ground materially changes, you notify your commanding officer." "I did that." "When you found Lutz's body, yes. You should have done it the moment you saw the dead dogs." "I made a judgment call." "Of course," the colonel nods. "You always do, Mr. McQueen. One judgment call after another. Most of them have been good, I have to admit, but it was only a matter of time." "Why?" McQueen demands, contempt thickening his voice. "Because your judgment is so much better than mine?" "No," the colonel says, with the same infuriating calm. "Because armies work by simple algorithms. Procedure, however pointless it seems, is there to lessen the chance of error. It filters all the decisions you make through a bed of cross-checks and fail-safes, but only if you use it." "You could be a fine soldier, Mr. McQueen, if only you weren't in an army of one." McQueen shakes his head, bitter, but also, now that the first rush of anger and surprise has passed, coldly amused. This has a symmetry to it. Carlyle is describing him exactly as he sees himself, but upside down, so that all his virtues are vices and presumably all the colonel's own failings are strengths. "I have to ask," he says, "were you following the algorithms when you bombed Cambridge and Stansted? When you did the burn runs and fried all those people in their beds, did that decision filter through okay?" Carlyle's mouth tugs down as though he's got a hook in his lower lip. That one hurt. "Yes," he says, "and no, respectively. I did what I could within the system to stop the burn runs from happening, but it didn't work. The wrong decision was made. I offer no excuses for that." "No," McQueen agrees, his face inches from the other man's. "And you got no reprimands for it either, did you? I put a dozen men and women in danger, but they all lived. You killed thousands and walked away with a medal." "You're mistaken. Nobody gave me a medal." "I'm sure they'll get around to it, sir. Just a matter of time, if you don't mind me saying." The colonel is silent for a moment or two. "Is there anything else?" he asks at last. "Only what I've already said. I've got more experience with the field pounder than anyone. The flamethrower, too. Let me do my job." "If I thought you could do your job, we wouldn't be having this conversation." Words are bubbling up in McQueen's throat. Saying them won't do any good. He leaves the way he came, runs the same gauntlet of resentment and solidarity. He has no use for either. But in Rosie, there's only ever one route from A to B. Chapter 25. Sunrise finds the crew up and at it. Cat Foss, as ranking officer, and how crazy is that, leads the charge. Not that there's much need for leadership, as far as she can see. Everyone does what has to be done without being told. The motion sensors and immobilizer traps were a sacred mystery once, but 7 months have made their operation tediously familiar. So the white coats dismantle the perimeter, while Foss leads a detail down to the loch with the 10-gallon water drums. Rosie has integral tanks that fill with rainwater runoff, but Colonel Carlyle is a belt-and-braces man. When they get back from the loch, the roles rotate. The white coats add purification tablets to the water drums and stow them in the galley. Foss puts the soldiers onto the maintenance allocation checks. The MAC routine is prescribed by Rosie's operational manual, which Foss keeps in her hand the whole time and cribs from about 10 times a minute. There's a long and exhaustive list of checks covering the treads, the engine, and the environmental controls. Some of them are just diagnostic. Others involve getting down and dirty with oil cans, spanners, and wrenches. Lutz knew the book by heart, and gave everyone else the reassurance of a safety net, a better pair of eyes verifying everything they did. Lutz being unavoidably dead, Foss does the best she can. She stands over Phillips and Sixsmith the whole time, watching them with a nervous, critical eye. Then, when they're done, she makes them go through the entire list again, out of a general sense that cock-ups are hovering over them and waiting to descend. They're going home. Not a one of them quite believes that yet, and not a one of them wants to jinx it. But in spite of Foss's slightly obsessive thoroughness, it's still early when they leave. Colonel Carlyle surrenders the driving seat to Sixsmith, its rightful occupant, but remains in the cab so he can use its comms rig to talk to everyone in the main crew space. Foss takes the midsection lookout and gives Phillips the turret. She is still hesitant about giving orders to McQueen. Everyone apart from the lookout straps in and waits for takeoff. They won't stay strapped in, of course. Rosie's top speed is 20 miles per hour on a good road, but there are no good roads left. She picks her way slowly along Britain's rutted sclerotic arteries, and drops to an 8-mile-an-hour average when she leaves the tarmac for the scenic route. Most day-to-day activities, whether work or leisure, aren't inhibited by her easy trundling. But this is turnaround, a day they have been anticipating for a long time. Soldiers and white coats alike are showing a due respect. In fact, the scientists seem downright somber. Foss can see where they're coming from, too. More than half a year on the road and nothing to show for it. For all the good they got out of those endless shoot-em-ups and cut-em-ups, they might just as well have been picking blackberries. Better off, in fact. Fresh fruit is hard currency in Beacon. If Beacon is still there. But it must be. Nothing would have torn the whole camp down so completely that they couldn't even squeeze a word out. So the lack of comms must be a technical hitch. That's all it can be. So, personally, she's in a pretty buoyant mood. The image of Lutz's body almost cut up into pieces is still vivid in her mind. Much more vivid than any particular memories of him alive. But the fact that they're heading home early is the best news she has had since they set out. And going back with a field commission would be the icing on the cake if she didn't feel so bad for, it's just force of habit but she can't break it, the lieutenant. McQueen only did what the rest of them were thinking of doing, so where's the sense in pretending he's the one to blame? When he put his hands on the guns and the turret turned and the fire spewed out, Foss felt almost like it was happening because she was willing it to. If anything, she wishes she'd got there first. Now, vicariously, she feels herself slapped down by McQueen's punishment. She doesn't believe she's alone in that. Damn, if she isn't sliding into the same grim mood as the white coats. She drags herself out of it again by thinking about what she'll do when she gets home. First, go to the 27 Pavilion and get wasted. Then take a tumble or two with some guy blessed with a respectably sized dick and a sense of direction. There are exactly 2 men on board Rosie who she was ever sexually interested in, Phillips and Akinwe, and, story of her life. They only have eyes for each other. Finally, go home and wave her Lieutenant Pips in her father's face. How do you like that sleeve candy, quartermaster sergeant? That's a recipe for a good day right there. And now that they're heading south again, it can't be more than a few days away. Rosie's frame shudders as the engine comes awake. The throbbing climbs and peaks. Sixsmith is dropping down through the gears for a start that will lift them up out of the footprint made by their own massive weight. She knows Rosie better than anyone now Lutz is dead. They rock back and forth a little as she makes herself some room to maneuver. Then, with a huge lurch and a basso fart of hydraulics, they're underway. That counts as a smooth takeoff, and it gets a fair bit smoother as soon as they're moving. There's a scatter of applause from the crew quarters. "Too kind," says Sixsmith on the intercom. "Your stewardesses will be passing down the aisles shortly, serving drinks and recreational drugs." There's a click and the colonel's voice takes over. "Midsection," he says tersely. "Report in." "We're good here," Foss answers. Phillips begs to differ. "Sir," he says from up in the turret, "I'm seeing movement." Shit, what has she missed? Foss puts her fantasies of home sweet home aside for later, and takes a look through the telltale in the midsection door, which she should have done before she opened her mouth. She sees nothing but tall trees and weed-choked fields, blurred into green soup by their motion. "Port or starboard?" she demands. "Your side. 5 o'clock. "I'm not getting anything, Colonel." 10 o'clock, too," Philip says, tense as hell. "We've definitely got company." Foss looks again. Still, just landscape in her field of vision. Nothing moving that shouldn't be. "Phillips, tell me what you're seeing," the colonel orders.
"I can't, sir. Sorry, it's just glimpses here and there among the trees. I'm not getting a clear line on it." "Rabbits?" Foss guesses. "Foxes?"
Not great suggestions, either of them. There just isn't a whole lot of wildlife about these days. Anything with a pulse is fair game for the Hungries. They prefer warm blood, but they'll take what they can get. There's a long, strained silence. Then Phillips swears. "Gone?" the colonel asks.
"I don't know, sir. I keep thinking I'm seeing something, but they're way low down."
Which implies animal rather than human. Junkers might crawl to stay under the cover of the weeds, but they couldn't do that and keep pace with a moving tank. "Still nothing here," Foss says. She's looking a lot harder now. She trusts her own eyes, but from upstairs, Phillips has 2 meters of height on her position, and he doesn't panic easily. Neither does the colonel, but as previously noted, he likes to go belt and braces. "Sixsmith, give us some legs. Phillips, see if there are any blips in the infrared."
"Nothing, sir,"
Phillips reports in due course. Foss can hear the relief in his voice, and she shares it. Junkers would show as hot spots in the infrared, as would live animals of any kind. So it's just Hungries, most likely, drawn by the sound of the engines as they started off. There are only so many layers of baffle you can add to an engine cowling and still move. Hungries can outrun Rosie, but only in the short term. It shouldn't be long before they've got the road to themselves again. "All good?" the colonel demands. This time Foss and Phillips agree that it is. The phantom blips are forgiven and forgotten. Rosie is going home. Chapter 26. As soon as they're underway, Greaves springs his seat strap and retreats from the crew quarters into the lab. He hopes he might get a little time to himself there, since working when they're on the move isn't a popular option. It's too hard to compensate for the rocking of Rosie's chassis. A few shattered test tubes and ruined samples were enough to wean most of the science team off the habit. But not today. He is followed almost immediately by Rena. He's afraid for a moment that she will offer to help him, but it seems she's got a project of her own to pursue. She flashes him a smile as she moves past him towards the further workbench. It's a weak smile. Greaves assigns it meaning C, you are my friend, on a list that goes all the way to N, I'm thinking of something that you wouldn't understand. Getting harder and harder to work around me, isn't it? Rena asks, patting her protuberant belly. Don't let me get in your way, Stephen. He considers telling her that there is still more than a foot of clearance on either side of the central walkway if she stands in its center. But he is almost certain, from her smile which has now transitioned into a D, that she intends the comment as a joke. He offers a smile in return, usually the safest option, and goes back to his work. From the crew quarters come the voices of Celia and Akimwe. They are discussing Cordyceps, the great adversary, its culture and historical significance, with special reference to Chinese folk legends about its life cycle. Greaves is well aware that the Chinese, almost 3,000 years ago, saw the fungus sprouting from the exploded bodies of caterpillars and thought they had chanced upon a magical metamorphosis. A creature that was an animal in summer and a mushroom in winter. They prized cordyceps as a treatment for heart disease and impotence, the distilled essence of life itself. Later generations found that the fungus could grow through damaged nerve tissue and partially repair it. There's a prevailing theory that these medicinal uses of the fungus were the precursors to the Hungry Plague, the doorway through which cordyceps infected human populations. Tuning out the voices, Greaves prepares the tissue collected by the biopsy needle for examination. He uses the Atlum, a machine perfected at Harvard's Center for Brain Science in the years immediately preceding the breakdown. It's a microtome, a lathe for slicing neural tissue into ultrafine sections of a single cell's thickness. The Atlum mounts the sections onto a continuous ribbon of tape rather than onto conventional slides. It therefore allows the user, at least the user with a scanning electron microscope ready to hand, to build up a three-dimensional view of brain structures and to follow them down through successive strata of tissue. Greaves finds the operation of the Atlum utterly enthralling. It peels tissue samples the way you might peel an apple with your pocket knife, then rebuilds them into an apple again. When he mounts and examines his sample, though, he is confused. The children have already demonstrated that they are not at all like other Hungries. Their behavioural repertoire is vast, perhaps as large as that of regular humans, so he expects to see little or no fungal penetration of the brain tissue. Instead, he finds himself staring at a dense mat of fungal mycelia. The brain is one vast spiderweb of threads, woven about and through the various neurons all the way from the outer cortex to the thalamus and transverse fissure. By volume, this brain is half human and half fungus. But where is the damage? The human cerebral matter ought to have been hollowed out, devoured by the fungal invader. There ought to be a 55% to 80% reduction in actual brain mass, and a visible degeneration of whatever tissue still remains. A crust of microglial cells overlaying the damaged cortical areas. Myelin sheaths stripped away, leaving bare neurons firing fitfully and futilely into synaptic gaps that have become mud wallows of necrotic juices. None of that is present. If this brain has been invaded, it is mounting a robust defense. Or is this a moment rather than a state? Just a brief equilibrium before the cerebral tissue surrenders and the fungus carries the day? But in that case, how is the brain held out for so long, surrounded and besieged? There is some factor at work that he has never seen before, and the implications are immense, almost dizzying. Greaves raises his head from the eyepiece and looks around furtively. He feels for a moment as though the beating of his heart, the tremor in his breathing, must have been noticed. But Rena isn't looking at him at all. She is focused on her own work, her preoccupied calm contrasting with his own sudden burst of excitement and near panic. He goes back in. This time he abandons the microscope for a while, draws off another tissue sample, and begins a series of tests for the presence of the major neurotransmitters, The chemicals that turn the brain from a lump of inert flesh into the world's biggest communications hub. There are well over 100 of these chemical couriers, but Greaves limits himself for the moment to a sample of about 30, the ones that show up quickly in the presence of off-the-shelf reagents. Half of the chemical transmitters are present in the same strengths and proportions as a normal human brain. The rest aren't there at all. Which is impossible. He knows how cordyceps is meant to work, how it works in every hungry studied so far. Seconds after primary infection, it floods the human host's bloodstream where it proliferates with breathtaking speed. Carried through the blood-brain barrier, it lodges in the brainstem and launches a preemptive strike, deactivating normal neural functioning by destructive superstimulation of the nerve cells. It burns the brain out. Then it grows downwards again, into and through the spine, extending its mycelial system along the host body's major afferent nerve trunks. With the brain out of the conversation, apart from a few powerful instinctive behaviours controlled through the pons and medulla, the fungus is free to hijack the peripheral nervous system and to use it to take direct control of the host's motor functions. So in a heavily infected brain, native neurotransmitter activity should be minimal to non-existent. There may still be a consciousness in there, the experts at Beacon have argued it back and forth without reaching a conclusion, but either way, it doesn't matter. The strings have been cut. This brain is different. Structurally, it's intact, and chemically, it's halfway functional. But what good is half a brain? You can't drive a car if it has a carburetor but no spark plug, cylinders but no pistons. It's not as though half a brain could run half the body's systems. Your limbs can't be made to move without dopamine or acetylcholine. You can't have a proper sleep cycle without adenosine, or hunger and satiety reflexes without noradrenaline. So the fungus must still be running the show, surely. However healthy the brain tissue looks in cross-section. But Greaves has seen how these children behave. Aside from the hunger, they remind him of real people. Turn the question on its head. If this child, when he was alive, had a partial immunity to some of the hungry pathogen's effects, then what was the mechanism? There is nothing unusual in the cellular structures Greaves is seeing, except that they are still pristine, still viable, when they should be bombed out shells. He ponders. Form follows function, but it also dictates function. There is a reason why the hungries are called that, after all. Obviously, the hunger reflex is the first thing that cordyceps hijacks. More than anything else, it needs its host to eat, carrying the infection with every bite. He saw the little girl go after that pigeon, and he saw her tribe feeding on dog flesh in the streets of Invercrae. The children have that instinct, that drive, just as strongly as the regular hungries have it, however different they may be in other ways. So what is happening here? Is this just a refinement of the pathogen's normal onset and progression, or is it something completely new? He needs to look at spinal tissue to see what cordyceps is doing down there, but he can't take a fresh biopsy with Rena in the lab working right beside him. Reluctantly, he dismounts his slides and samples and stows them in his personal area, where they won't be touched. Rena hasn't looked up once in all this time. What she is doing shouldn't be that absorbing, though. It's a fairly basic mechanical procedure. She is neutralizing sulfuric acid with magnesium carbonate, which is a quick and easy way to produce... Oh. Dr. Khan looks up at last and meets his stare. The guarded blankness of it confirms his guess. Greaves has had to learn people the hard way, but chemistry is easy. He knows magnesium sulfate very well indeed. Its molecular profile, its chemical properties, and its bioregulatory effect. Dr. Khan almost certainly intends to take it as a tocolytic, to suppress contractions in her birth canal. The baby is coming, or at least announcing its intentions.
What? She asks, not realizing that her cover is blown. Greaves has no idea what an adequate response might be from the point of view of emotion and its abstruse architecture. But again, he is confident about the chemistry.
Nifedipine, Rena, he tells her. Nifedipine would be better if you want to delay the birth. We've got some in the med cabinet for hypertensive trauma.
Rena looks stunned. She puts down the retort she's been holding all this time, leans away from it a little as though she wants to disavow all knowledge. After a moment she laughs, shakes her head. Amazing, Holmes, she says.
What? Who is Holmes? Why is he amazing?
Never mind. Don't say a word to anyone, Stephen. I don't want to slow us down or make this stupid situation any worse than it is. Don't say anything. Please.
Greaves nods. He may not be able to lie, but he is 100% sure that nobody is going to ask him this particular question. If anyone asks a more general question, is something wrong with Dr. Khan, he can probably keep from giving away the secret by saying she is taking medicine commonly prescribed for stress. So he is confident that he can keep his word. He wishes he could diffuse his discovery of her intentions by confiding in her about his own immense project. But this is not the time. Soon, when he has findings rather than suppositions, when he has more to show her than a dead child. A dead child, he strongly suspects, will only add to her troubles right now.
Chapter 27 Dr. Fournier is still trying to coax a response out of the radio, but he has long since resigned himself to failure. He's only doing it now because he can think of nothing else to do that's of any value. So when the voice of Brigadier Fry's adjutant Mullings oozes weakly out of the radio in a viscous froth of static, he starts so violently that he cracks his right elbow on the engine cowling.
Beacon, please identify.
Get the Brigadier, the doctor snarls, doubled up around his injured arm. It's Fournier. Field report, urgency one.
She's conferring with her chiefs of staff, Dr. Fournier. You'll have to...
Another voice murmurs in the background. Fournier can't hear the words, but Mullings' robust,
"Yes, Brigadier,"
is loud enough to make him clap his hand over the radio's speaker and whisper a curse.
"Go ahead, then," Fry says. "Report, Dr. Fournier."
He tries to.
There hasn't been a transmission through the main cockpit radio in 2 weeks, Brigadier. We didn't know what was happening."
"I'm well aware of that, Doctor. I asked you to report on your own status, if you please."
"We had an incident. We lost a man. Private Lutz."
He tells her about Invercray, in somewhat unnecessary detail, steering away from the substantive point for as long as he can. But finally he says it.
"We're heading home."
"Are you now?"
the Brigadier asks mildly, after a momentary pause.
"And whose decision was that?"
"All of us. It was
the group decision. We had hard evidence of Junker activity, after all. It seemed..."
"You had a man down.
That in itself isn't evidence of anything.
Frankly, I'd say the fact that Rosie herself was not attacked argues against any Junker presence."
So here they are.
And of course Fournier is being required to bow his head and bear the blame. How very convenient a scapegoat is, especially in a situation where success is almost impossible. This time he fights back. "I made a judgment call based on the facts available to me. I also took into account the morale of the team and the frictions, very considerable frictions, between Colonel Carlyle and Lieutenant McQueen."
Fry sweeps these arguments away.
"What matters now," she says, "is to manage the situation. The timing is very unwelcome. We're in the middle of significant structural upheaval here, which is why there has been a hiatus in our communications to you.
The colonel's return at this point could be highly disruptive.
Fournier is ready to dig in his heels and argue his case, but now he feels a stirring of unease. Structural upheaval. He imagines the bleak landscape lying under those anodyne words, and he is unable to keep from lifting the blanket.
"When you say upheaval," he ventures, "do you mean..."
He tries to think of a neutral way to phrase the question, discovers that there isn't one.
"Has the muster taken charge of the main table?"
Fry's tone is surgically precise. "The main table has voluntarily ceded executive authority to the muster. A peaceful handover of power. We are not talking about a regime change, Doctor, but a logical reallocation of existing roles and priorities. Unfortunately, some extremist elements have refused to see it that way. They're taking this opportunity to press their own private resentments, and we're having to come down very hard on that."
"Is there an emergency?"
Fournier asks anxiously. He means besides what she has just described, of course. Was there some reason to do this apart from the end in itself of taking power?
"There was a need," the Brigadier says, "for firm and focused management of a volatile situation."
Fournier has no further questions. He has just heard a military coup being defined in words that make it sound like a school detention. He doesn't want to hear any more, in case it's worse than what he is already imagining. All his fight and all his grievances are gone out of him, suddenly. He thinks of asking, "What do you want me to do?" But even in his head that sounds feeble and vacillating. He can't let those words out into the world. He edits them into a slightly better shape.
"So, what are your orders?"
"First of all, and most urgently, disable the main cockpit radio at your earliest opportunity. We've been maintaining radio silence, obviously, but we want to guard against anyone else managing to contact Rosie."
"Anyone else?" Fournier hazards.
The Brigadier doesn't seem to hear.
"You can render the cockpit radio inoperable," she tells him, "by opening the fascia up with an Allen key and removing the smaller of the two circuit boards inset at the rear of the main motherboard. It will unclip very easily."
"Do this quickly, Doctor." "The longer you delay, the greater the risk. If the Colonel is apprised of events here at Beacon, he may wish to intervene."
"That's unacceptable."
"Very well, I think I can do that. Is there anything else?"
"Yes, of course there is. I need you to stay out in the field until further notice. We don't want Carlyle here, and we don't want Rosie. Not yet. When the situation stabilizes, we'll bring you in. Until then, find a way to stop or slow down."
Dr. Fournier feels that this is a very easy thing to say and a difficult thing to deliver. He is about to ask, with a carefully modulated amount of sarcasm, how the Brigadier thinks he's going to stop a tank. But at that moment, there is a lurch so abrupt that it slams his chair and his shoulder right up against the bulkhead. Rosie has stopped.
Chapter 28 I'm really sorry, sir, Private Sixsmith stammers. I didn't see it until we were right on top of it. The leaves!
She shrugs helplessly, then puts her hands back on the wheel, gripping it as if to draw some strength from it.
The leaves hid it, she says again. I didn't think there was anything there. I'm sorry.
She isn't finished with apologizing, but Carlyle shuts her down as gently as he can. They have to respond to what has just happened. Everything else can wait.
It's fine, Private, he says quietly. You reacted quickly and appropriately.
He opens the all channel on the comms rig, speaking to the crew quarters, lab, midsection and turret. From the crew quarters comes a chorus of raised voices. Seely keeps asking what just happened and Penny is crying.
Did we hit something? What did we hit?
There is nothing to worry about, the colonel broadcasts. Everybody stay where you are and please don't block the channel. Phillips,
Go to infrared again. Scan for hostiles.
Sir, Philip says, and then there is silence for most of a minute. A provisional silence, anyway, with only breathless whispers from the crew quarters, and from the